Imagine waking up one day to discover that your comfortable life has been shattered by forces beyond your control. This is precisely what happens to young Candide, the naive protagonist of Voltaire's most celebrated work. Published anonymously in 1759 and promptly banned throughout Europe, Candide became an immediate underground sensation that continues to captivate readers nearly three centuries later. The novella's razor-sharp wit has influenced countless writers, from Mark Twain to Kurt Vonnegut, while its philosophical questions about suffering and meaning remain startlingly relevant. Even Elon Musk once cited it as formative to his worldview, particularly its conclusion about the importance of practical action over abstract philosophizing. What makes this slim volume so enduring? Perhaps it's Voltaire's uncanny ability to blend laugh-out-loud comedy with profound questions about human existence, creating a work that entertains while challenging our deepest assumptions about how the world works. In the idyllic German province of Westphalia stands the magnificent castle of Baron Thundertentronckh, where young Candide leads a sheltered existence. The illegitimate nephew of the Baron, though this fact is only whispered in hushed tones among the servants, Candide possesses a sweet disposition and uncomplicated judgment, qualities reflected in his very name, which suggests both candor and innocence. The castle, with its imposing stone walls and meticulously maintained gardens, represents a microcosm of aristocratic European society, complete with a rigid hierarchy that places the corpulent baroness, weighing 350 pounds, at the pinnacle of respect, followed by her fresh-colored, plump 17-year-old daughter Cunegonde, whose beauty captivates the young Candide. The intellectual center of this miniature kingdom is Dr. Pangloss, the family tutor who teaches metaphysico-theologo-cosmologology, a discipline of his own invention that attempts to explain all phenomena through rational optimization. His central philosophical tenet, that this is the best of all possible worlds, where everything exists for a purpose, shapes Candide's entire worldview. According to Pangloss's elaborate reasoning, noses exist for spectacles, legs for stockings, stones were created to be hewn into castles, and pigs were made to be eaten. Even disasters and suffering, in Pangloss's view, ultimately serve some greater good. This philosophy, a thinly veiled parody of Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz's optimistic rationalism, provides Candide with a comforting framework for understanding the world, shielding him from life's harsh realities. Life in the castle follows a predictable routine, with Candide spending his days studying under Pangloss, admiring Cunegonde from afar, and accepting without question the social hierarchies and philosophical certainties that surround him. The castle's inhabitants live in splendid isolation, convinced of their own superiority and the perfection of their ordered existence. The servants bow, the Baron pronounces judgment, and Pangloss explains it all with unwavering certainty. The young man's paradise crumbles, however, when he innocently kisses Cunegonde's hand behind a screen in the castle's drawing room, a moment of pure impulse that defies the strict social order. The Baron, catching them in this forbidden act, transforms from a dignified nobleman to an enraged patriarch. He delivers a swift kick to Candide's backside and expels him from the castle, demonstrating how quickly the best of all possible worlds can turn cruel. In an instant, our protagonist finds himself thrust from his sheltered existence into a harsh world that will repeatedly challenge his mentor's optimistic philosophy. This abrupt transition from protected innocence to cruel reality establishes the pattern for the entire novel. Candide will continually encounter situations that test his faith in Pangloss's teachings that all is for the best in this most magnificent and most agreeable of all possible castles, forcing him to confront the gap between philosophical idealism and the brutal realities of human existence. Candide's first taste of the world's cruelty comes swiftly. Hungry and cold, he accepts hospitality from two blue-uniformed strangers who praise his height and appearance. Their seemingly generous offer of dinner and money masks their true intention, forcible enlistment in the Bulgarian army. When Candide attempts to exercise his free will by taking a walk, he's captured as a deserter and given the choice between 36 floggings or execution. Choosing the former, he endures a brutal 4,000 strokes before begging for death. Only the passing king of the Bulgars, clemency, saves him. Voltaire's depiction of military life is unflinchingly brutal, stripping away romantic notions of warfare. The Bulgarian army represents a mechanistic system that crushes individuality and free will. Soldiers are treated as interchangeable parts rather than thinking beings, a stark contrast to Pangloss's optimistic view of a rationally ordered universe. The arbitrary nature of Candide's punishment and subsequent pardon underscores the capriciousness of power and justice in the real world. The battle scene that follows is a masterpiece of satirical compression. Voltaire describes the brilliant spectacle of trumpets, fifes, and cannon creating a hellish harmony, while 30,000 souls perish. The juxtaposition of aesthetic beauty with mass death highlights the absurdity of glorifying warfare. Walking through villages burned by both sides, Candide witnesses old men wounded, women with throats cut, and children clinging to their murdered mothers. These horrors directly challenge Pangloss's assertion that all serves a greater purpose in the best of all possible worlds. What makes this section so powerful is how Voltaire uses Candide's innocence to heighten our perception of war's senselessness. Through his protagonist's eyes, we see the disconnect between philosophical abstractions and human suffering. The brutality Candide witnesses isn't serving some greater cosmic plan. It's simply the result of human cruelty and power politics. Candide's journey leads him to Holland, where he reunites with his former teacher Pangloss, now disfigured by disease and missing his nose and teeth. We learn that Cunegonde was ravished and dismembered by Bulgarian soldiers, who also killed her parents and destroyed the castle. Despite these horrors, Pangloss maintains his optimistic philosophy, insisting that his syphilis is necessary in the grand scheme because it originated with Columbus's voyage, which gave Europe chocolate and cochineal. A charitable Anabaptist named James takes both philosophers aboard his ship to Lisbon. During their voyage, Pangloss explains how everything is optimally arranged, while James disagrees, noting mankind's unnatural propensity for violence. Their philosophical debate is violently interrupted when a terrible tempest strikes as they approach Lisbon. Half the passengers are too sick to notice the danger, while others pray frantically. When the vessel wrecks, the kind Anabaptist James drowns while trying to save a brutish sailor who callously ignores his benefactor's plight. Upon reaching shore, they experience the devastating 1755 Lisbon earthquake that destroyed 3/4 of the city and killed 30,000 people. This historical disaster was a pivotal event that shook European intellectual confidence in divine providence. Voltaire masterfully uses it to highlight the inadequacy of Pangloss's philosophy when confronted with massive suffering. While Candide lies injured and begging for help, Pangloss refuses practical assistance, instead theorizing about how the earthquake connects to one in Lima through underground sulfur. The Portuguese authorities respond to the disaster by organizing an auto da fé, act of faith, a public ceremony where heretics are executed, believing this will prevent further earthquakes. Candide is flogged for listening to Pangloss's heretical optimism, while Pangloss himself is hanged. Ironically, another earthquake strikes that same day, undermining the supposed efficacy of the ritual. Bloodied and trembling, Candide questions Pangloss's optimism. If this is the best of all possible worlds, what are the others like? This section brilliantly illustrates how both religious superstition and philosophical optimism fail when confronted with natural disaster. Neither the auto da fé nor Pangloss's rationalizations provide meaningful comfort or explanation for suffering on this scale. The earthquake becomes Voltaire's most powerful argument against Leibnizian optimism. Nature's indifference to human concerns cannot be reconciled with the idea of a perfectly designed universe. Just when Candide has reached his lowest point, an old woman mysteriously appears and leads him to his beloved Cunegonde, alive. Their joyful reunion reveals Cunegonde's harrowing survival story. Though she was indeed ravished by Bulgarian soldiers and wounded, she survived these accidents and eventually became the shared property of two men, Don Issachar, a wealthy Jewish banker, and the Grand Inquisitor who had presided over Pangloss's execution and Candide's flogging. The time-sharing arrangement between these powerful men, Don Issachar gets Mondays, Wednesdays, and the Sabbath, while the Inquisitor claims the other 4 days, represents one of Voltaire's most biting satires of religious hypocrisy. The Inquisitor, supposedly a model of Christian virtue, engages in the very sins he condemns in others. Meanwhile, Cunegonde has been reduced to a commodity, passed between men as property with no agency of her own. When Don Issachar discovers Candide with Cunegonde, he attacks with a sword. Candide, though gentle by nature, defends himself and kills the banker. Before they can recover from this shock, the Grand Inquisitor arrives for his scheduled time with Cunegonde. Realizing he faces certain execution for killing Don Issachar, Candide reasons that, since he's already begun bloodshed, he might as well kill the Inquisitor too, which he promptly does. This darkly comic sequence highlights how quickly violence escalates and how moral principles collapse under pressure. Candide, our innocent hero, becomes a double murderer in the space of minutes. The old woman, revealed to be a fellow survivor of terrible misfortunes, advises immediate escape. The three fugitives flee to Cadiz, where Candide is recruited into a military expedition against Jesuit priests in Paraguay who have established their own kingdom. Voltaire uses this section to explore how power corrupts religious institutions. The Inquisitor's hypocrisy represents the Catholic Church's worldly corruption, while the Jesuits in Paraguay represent religious orders that acquire political power. Through Cunegonde's exploitation, we see how women particularly suffer in systems where they have no legal or social standing apart from men. Her story is a powerful indictment of a world where the vulnerable become pawns in power struggles between the privileged. The old woman who rescued Candide reveals her own extraordinary history, providing one of the novel's most powerful arguments against philosophical optimism. Born the daughter of Pope Urban IX and the Princess of Palestrina, she was raised in splendor until 14, when her engagement to the handsome Prince of Massa Carrara ended with his death from poisoned chocolate. What follows is a catalog of increasingly horrific misfortunes, captured by pirates, witnessing her mother torn to pieces in Morocco, nearly dying of plague, being sold repeatedly across North Africa and the Middle East, and finally having one buttock cut off to feed starving soldiers during a siege. Despite contemplating suicide often, she clung to life, an absurd instinct shared by many miserable souls she's met. The old woman's tale serves multiple purposes in Voltaire's narrative strategy. First, it provides a female perspective on suffering that emphasizes sexual violence and objectification, experiences largely absent from male philosophical discussions of evil. Second, it expands the geographic and cultural scope of the novel, showing that suffering is universal across religions and societies. Finally, it directly challenges Pangloss's optimism by demonstrating that misfortune is not exceptional but endemic to human existence. What makes her story particularly effective is how it combines the grotesque with the tragic. The absurd detail of her missing buttock becomes a physical manifestation of how suffering marks and transforms us. Yet, despite everything she's endured, the old woman maintains a practical wisdom and resilience that contrasts sharply with Pangloss's abstract theorizing. When she tells Cunegonde, "I have lived," it carries the weight of experience that no philosophy can match. The old woman's conclusion, that despite everything, humans cling to life, raises profound questions about human nature. Is our persistence mere instinct, or does it reflect some deeper meaning? Voltaire offers no easy answers, but the question itself challenges both religious explanations of suffering and philosophical optimism. After a series of misadventures in South America, including killing Cunegonde's brother, who has become a Jesuit commander, and escaping from cannibals, Candide and his valet Cacambo discover El Dorado, a hidden utopian kingdom. This legendary land of gold, inaccessible behind mountains, represents everything European society is not: peaceful, rational, and genuinely virtuous. In El Dorado, gold and precious stones are mere pebbles with no monetary value. The inhabitants worship one god with daily thanksgiving, but have no priests to dispute theological points or persecute dissenters. Their king is wise and humble, receiving visitors without ceremony despite living in a magnificent palace. Science and the arts flourish, and everyone lives in harmony. What makes El Dorado particularly significant is that it represents a genuinely good society, not perfect through divine intervention or philosophical abstraction, but through rational human organization. It shows that Voltaire isn't merely a cynic, he can envision a better world. However, this ideal society remains isolated from the rest of humanity, protected by inaccessible mountains that prevent European greed from corrupting it. Candide's response to El Dorado reveals much about human nature. Despite finding a peaceful paradise, he grows restless after a month. Motivated by love for Cunegonde and the prospect of being wealthy in Europe with El Dorado's pebbles, he chooses to leave this utopia. As he tells Cacambo, "If we remain here, we shall only be like others, whereas if we return to our world with merely a dozen El Dorado sheep loaded with pebbles, we shall be richer than all the kings put together." This decision illustrates a profound insight about human psychology. We measure our happiness not by absolute well-being, but by comparison with others. Perfect contentment without distinction holds less appeal than relative advantage in an imperfect world. Candide's choice also reflects how deeply we're shaped by our cultural values. Even after seeing a superior society, he cannot escape European notions of wealth and status. The El Dorado episode thus serves as both a critique of European society and a commentary on human nature itself. The perfect world exists, but remains forever beyond our reach, not just geographically, but psychologically, as our own values and desires prevent us from embracing it. After losing most of his El Dorado treasures through misfortune and deception, Candide selects a traveling companion who is most disgusted with life. He chooses Martin, a poor scholar who has suffered countless misfortunes and professes himself a Manichaean, believing the world is abandoned to evil. Their philosophical debates during their journey to Europe form the intellectual heart of the novel's second half. Martin's pessimism serves as a counterpoint to Pangloss's optimism, creating a dialectical structure through which Voltaire explores philosophical extremes. When Candide points to the kindness of the Anabaptist James as evidence of human goodness, Martin counters that such examples are rare exceptions. When they witness the Dutch pirate Vanderdender, who had robbed Candide, sink with his ill-gotten gains, Candide sees divine justice, while Martin notes that innocent passengers also perished. Their most revealing exchange occurs when Candide asks whether mankind has always been so cruel and deceitful. Martin replies by comparing humans to hawks, who have always eaten pigeons, suggesting human nature remains unchanged despite Candide's protests about free will. This naturalistic view directly challenges both religious and philosophical optimism by suggesting that evil is inherent in creation itself, not a temporary aberration in a fundamentally good universe. What makes these debates particularly effective is how they're constantly interrupted by real-world experiences that complicate both positions. In Paris, Candide falls ill and is immediately surrounded by false friends and pious ladies attracted by his visible wealth. Martin wryly notes that when he was poor in Paris, he recovered without such attention. This episode confirms Martin's cynicism about human nature while also showing how wealth corrupts social relationships. Yet Martin's complete pessimism proves as inadequate as Pangloss's blind optimism. When they visit the wealthy Venetian nobleman Pococurante, who has every luxury but takes pleasure in nothing, Martin observes that he dislikes everything he possesses, suggesting there was a pleasure in having no pleasure. This profound emptiness reveals the limitations of pure negativity. Rejecting everything leaves one as disconnected from reality as accepting everything uncritically. Through these philosophical dialogues, Voltaire demonstrates that abstract systems, whether optimistic or pessimistic, fail to capture the complexity of human experience. Neither Pangloss nor Martin can adequately explain a world that contains both extraordinary cruelty and unexpected kindness, senseless suffering, and moments of joy. The novel's conclusion brings together all major characters in Constantinople. Candide discovers that Cunegonde has become horribly ugly, working as a dishwasher, while Pangloss has survived hanging, the executioner was incompetent, and still maintains his optimistic philosophy despite everything. Even more surprisingly, Cunegonde's brother, the Baron, has also survived and still refuses to allow his sister to marry someone of inferior rank, despite Candide having twice saved his life. After sending the Baron back to the galleys for his arrogance, the group settles on a small farm outside Constantinople. Despite escaping numerous disasters and still possessing some diamonds, their life proves far from idyllic. Cunegonde grows uglier and more difficult daily, and his companions all suffer their own miseries. When Paquette and Brother Giroflée arrive destitute after squandering gifts Candide had given them, Martin's pessimism seems confirmed. Seeking wisdom, they consult a famous dervish who dismisses their questions about evil with contempt, telling them to hold your tongue when they ask why man exists. Later, they meet a simple Turkish farmer who cultivates 20 acres with his children, avoiding three great evils, boredom, vice, and want, through productive work. This modest example provides the novel's famous conclusion: we must cultivate our garden. This deceptively simple phrase contains the essence of Voltaire's practical philosophy. After exploring the inadequacies of both optimism and pessimism, he suggests that meaningful life comes not through abstract theorizing, but through productive engagement with the world. Cultivating our garden works on multiple levels. Literally, it means productive labor that provides sustenance and purpose. Metaphorically, it suggests tending to our immediate sphere of influence rather than trying to comprehend cosmic questions beyond human understanding. Philosophically, it represents a middle path between Pangloss's blind acceptance and Martin's complete rejection of the world. The little society embraces useful work, each developing skills that make their modest life bearable. When Pangloss attempts one final philosophical explanation about how their misfortunes led to their current state, Candide simply repeats, "We must cultivate our garden." This gentle but firm rejection of abstract philosophy in favor of practical action represents Voltaire's ultimate response to the problem of evil. What makes this conclusion so powerful is its modesty. Voltaire doesn't offer utopian solutions or religious consolation, just the dignity of meaningful work and human connection in a flawed world. The garden is limited, requiring constant maintenance and always vulnerable to destruction. Yet within these limitations, we can create meaning and even happiness through our own efforts. Nearly three centuries after its publication, Candide remains startlingly relevant to contemporary readers. Its critique of religious fanaticism, war, colonialism, and slavery speaks directly to ongoing global conflicts, from religious extremism in the Middle East to economic exploitation in developing nations. Its skepticism toward grand philosophical systems that explain away suffering resonates in a world still plagued by ideological extremism, whether in the form of market fundamentalism, political dogmatism, or religious absolutism. The novella's sharp critique of those who justify human suffering through abstract theories eerily parallels modern attempts to rationalize inequality, environmental destruction, and social injustice. What makes Candide particularly powerful is Voltaire's masterful balance of horror and humor. The novella induces laughter while prompting reflection on human suffering, moving seamlessly from absurdist comedy to profound tragedy. Its tragicomic vision acknowledges the darkness of existence while refusing either despair or naive optimism. This balance reflects Voltaire's vast intellectual breadth and personal experience. At 64, when writing Candide, he had witnessed the full spectrum of human behavior, from nobility to cruelty, including his own exile, imprisonment, and encounters with both European aristocracy and common people across the continent. The garden metaphor that concludes the work offers a vision of modest hope that speaks to modern environmental and social concerns. We cannot create perfect societies like El Dorado, nor should we accept injustice as part of some cosmic plan. Instead, we must work within our limitations to create meaning and reduce suffering where possible. This practical wisdom avoids both the complacency of optimism and the paralysis of pessimism, suggesting that local, tangible action matters more than grand schemes for global transformation. Perhaps most significantly, Candide challenges us to examine our own philosophical assumptions in ways that remain deeply relevant. Do we, like Pangloss, cling to beliefs that explain away suffering rather than addressing it, whether through economic theories, political ideologies, or religious doctrines? Do we, like Martin, see only the darkness in human nature, becoming cynical about the possibility of positive change? Or can we find the courage to face reality without illusion while still working to improve our small corner of the world? In an age of ideological polarization, environmental crisis, and global inequality, Voltaire's message remains essential. Philosophical systems matter less than practical compassion and constructive action. His emphasis on practical engagement over theoretical speculation offers guidance for addressing contemporary challenges, from climate change to social justice. We must indeed cultivate our garden, not just for ourselves, but for all who share this imperfect world, recognizing that small, sustained efforts toward improvement may be more valuable than sweeping ideological solutions. The wisdom of Candide lies in its recognition that meaningful change often begins with local action and personal responsibility, even as we acknowledge the broader systemic challenges we face.